I want to thank everyone for taking the time to be here. I am the author of Defying Displacement. It's based on 15 years work doing housing defense and tenant defense. And it's based on interviews with over a dozen activists around the country, looking at what I call the gentrification economy. Because the housing crisis is here, and the housing crisis is in so many places. When we look at what this actually means in human terms, we're talking about people's lives getting destroyed, either literally, physically, because they expire on the streets, because they're forced to stay with abusive parents or in abusive relationships, because they're forced to live in unsafe and undignified housing, or because the very fact of displacement means that we're torn from our social lives, we're torn from our communities, we're torn from the places where things make sense to us. And I think that this is more apt than ever, given what we're seeing happening on the national level, where tech oligarchs, the richest and wealthiest men on the planet, are being handed directly the levers of government to enact and enforce public policy themselves. So now is a moment where we can learn from the people who have been fighting these very same oligarchs, the people who are living in their backyards, the predominantly Black, brown, and immigrant communities that have been fighting these very same men for survival through the process of gentrification. Now, what is gentrification? I think that we talk about it in a way that is confused and confusing. Sometimes people talk about gentrification as if it's any improvement to a neighborhood, right? Whenever a neighborhood gets nicer or gets more amenities, that's gentrification. And from that perspective, which I think is incorrect, we can ask all kinds of stupid questions. Is gentrification actually bad for poor people? Does gentrification actually cause displacement? Shouldn't we want disinvested communities to get a little gentrified? And I can prove to you that that's incomprehensible. Because imagine a small town of affluent homeowners, right? A small town of affluent homeowners where no one is at risk of being displaced. If that neighborhood gets more amenities, if the one pothole gets fixed, if they get two bougie yoga studios instead of one, no one calls that gentrification. No one calls that gentrification. Why? Because no one is being displaced. Right? When neighborhoods get nicer and no one is forced out, no one is forced to double up or triple up with their extended family in a two-bedroom apartment, we don't call it gentrification because gentrification names something different. Gentrification names a pattern of economic displacement that we have seen emerge in the United States and around the world in the last 50 years. Displacement has always happened. Gentrification has not. And gentrification doesn't happen by chance. It doesn't happen by accident. It happens as a concerted economic plan whose agents include the most powerful and wealthy men in human history. The neighborhoods that get gentrified today are also not random. Right? It's predominantly Black, brown, and immigrant communities. And this doesn't happen just because of casual racism, although these people are in fact casually racist. It happens for economic reasons. There's a lot of white folks here today. I don't know if y'all have ever heard your friends or family members say, you know, I don't have a racist bone in my body. I don't care if you're Black, white, green, yellow, brown, purple. Tell people to stop saying that, because if I turn purple, I want someone to call an ambulance. If you don't, if you don't care if I turn purple, that's depraved neglect. That's actually a crime. But imagine a housing investor who is that proverbial white without a racist bone in his body, right? Even if I had no racial animus at all, I would target Black, brown, and immigrant communities for removal every time. Why? If I'm investing in housing, my potential profit is the difference between what a house is valued at now and what it will be valued at after reinvestment. So there's a whole bunch of things that could make that value rise, and that represents my profit, right? The university builds a new research center. They put in more public transit. There's like a tech campus that wants to employ tens of thousands of highly paid workers in tech or in biotech. All these things would make my investment more valuable. But one of the chief determinants of property value in the United States today is race of a building's occupants and the surrounding neighborhood. The Brookings Institute, hardly a hotbed of radical research, found that if you have two identical homes, identical quality, identical amenities, identical condition, identical resources, and one is occupied by a white family in a white neighborhood, and the other is occupied by a Black family in the Black neighborhood, the white occupied house is worth $48,000 more than the Black occupied home in a Black neighborhood. So again, as that proverbially non-racist developer, I know I can realize a profit on my investment through new amenities, through new jobs, but I can also get $48,000 simply through ethnic cleansing. That represents my profit as an investor because of the nature of racial capitalism in the US housing market. So the same neighborhoods are targeted for what they call revitalization and what they call reinvestment over and over and over again. The same neighborhoods of color, the same ethnic enclaves. And let's remember why these communities are in cities in the first place, right? Because let me tell you, it wasn't because all y'all's grandparents believed in building bridges, not walls. You know what I mean? People came to work. People came to work industrial jobs. And those jobs are gone. So another part of gentrification we have to look at is gentrification not only as a problem in itself, but gentrification as a symptom of a really profound transformation in global capitalism. If you thought about the US economy around the time of the Vietnam War, you would think about firms like the big three automakers in Detroit being the engine of the US economy. And Lockheed Martin, but some things never change. Those jobs are gone. The communities that held the workers for their jobs have survived as the US has transitioned to a service-based economy through outsourcing and automation. When we think about the most profitable companies in the contemporary US economy, they're finance, they're real estate firms, and they're tech companies. All of these firms also need workers, but they need much fewer workers with many more years of education, who they pay correspondingly higher amounts. And these are the gentrifiers. It's finance, it's real estate, it's tech, it's the elite universities that train workers for all of the above. And cities around the country, these people are very explicit when they don't think you and I are listening to them. The predominant problematic for urban planning over the past two decades has been how to attract gentrifiers, how to bring in the knowledge economy, how to create superstar cities. What is the difference between post-industrial Detroit and a place like the Silicon Valley, where I lived when I started writing this book? And the first answer that will come to mind is that one is post-industrial and one is not. And that's not, strictly speaking, true. Silicon Valley originally was an industrial area because microchips were produced domestically. Places like San Jose, California, urbanized to house workers on microchip assembly factory lines, just like Detroit urbanized to house workers in automobile factories, right? Both cities deindustrialized. The only difference between the contemporary Silicon Valley and post-recession Detroit is that Silicon Valley got gentrifiers working for tech companies. So local leaders, city councils, urban planning nerds, all of these people for the past two decades have been looking at these two examples and thinking, dear God, what can we do so that we end up more like contemporary Silicon Valley and less like post-industrial Detroit? So these cities are falling over themselves, not just nationally, but throughout the capitalist world system, to attract gentrifying industries, to attract gentrifiers, which means that they are consciously working, consciously, purposefully, to expel their current residents. I also wrote a zine for the Institute for Anarchist Studies on democracy and democracy beyond the state. And this is a problem, I think, for people who like local government, for people who like civic engagement, for people who believe in the bourgeois capitalist state. Because this is what your representatives are doing today. They are planning on ways to expel their constituents, the people who voted for them, the people whom they are supposed to represent. So people across the country and around the world are fighting back. Because gentrification isn't just a problem in places like New York City or LA. This is happening in Cape Town. This is happening in Berlin. This is happening in Shanghai. This is happening in Seoul. This is happening in Rio de Janeiro. This is a global problem and a global system for any country that is connected to capitalist world markets. They are seeking gentrification. They are yearning for gentrification, because this is what is incentivized for municipalities to capture value in the contemporary world economy. What demand could be more modest than asking for the preservation of your community and your home? Let's think back to the 60s again. What were people demanding? People were demanding that things got better. Right? We want community control of the police. We want health clinics in our community. We want culturally responsive education and schools with teachers who come from the same communities as the students they teach. We want resources. We want things to be better. Today, after 50 years of progress, what are we demanding? Please let me keep paying absurd rents to the same absentee landlord, send my kids to the same underfunded, poisonous schools, keep drinking the same unfit water, eating the same unfit food, and still having not enough money left over at the end of the month. And our government and the most powerful men in human history say that is too much. We cannot let you have that. But that is something people will fight for. That is something people will die for. To be able to have a place for ourselves, to have a place for our elders, to have a place for our kids, to have a place for the next generation. This, again, is not a utopian dream because, you know, that same affluent white suburban community I raised earlier, there are communities throughout this country where people don't leave unless they want to, right? We all know it. There are communities where people don't leave unless they want to. They got into a good college. They're moving to Florida and they're old. There are people choose to leave. I have a better investment opportunity somewhere. I got a better job. People leave because they want to. But demanding that for the people who have built this country, the people who have also been victimized by global imperialism, who after hundreds of years of deprivation and oppression have been told, you can have one crappy little neighborhood. That's what you get. You get one little neighborhood. And then 50 years later, you don't even get that. When those people demand those same standards that we get to decide when to leave, that poses a threat to the entire political and economic system. And that is what is so powerful about fights against gentrification. You know, I think a lot of times we think about radical demands or radical, when we think about radical movements having to come out of radical demands, right? Like the liberals make, the moderates make small demands, and the liberals make, you know, in the middle demands. So as radicals, we need to make very big, expansive demands. Abolish the police yesterday, a pony for every American. And I think there's actually something very powerful about demands that seem modest, but that aren't. Democratic socialist types like to talk about non-reformist reforms, by which they mean social democratic reforms, right? As if revolution is like 100 and like real reformy reforms are like 25. Like non-reformist reform is like 75. Unlike all of them, I've actually read the book that comes from, and that's not what he means at all. And funnily enough, he actually critiques the idea that you could use that to demand universal healthcare as a non-reformist reform. He's like, that's not what I mean by any means. An actual non-reformist reform in the original sense is a reform that seems like it's something that the capitalist state could give us, but in fact can only be accomplished by a radical movement. And I think there's something very powerful in that. Like, what was the demand of 2020? Stop murdering black people and running a society based on white supremacy and its products. And we saw that the system could not respond to that because you can't. Because the American government can't answer that reform while still existing. And that's what gave the movement so much power, because it is a modest demand, and it is a demand that the state cannot fulfill, right? What about Me Too? People shouldn't get sexually assaulted because they're women. That's another very modest demand. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, now we have to undo gender. I think that there's something very powerful in saying we want to stay in our homes. We want homes for everyone. We want homes for everyone, not just in the United States, right? Not just because like, oh, we're the richest country in the world, but every human being in every, not only in the imperial core, but in every colonized country, in every neo-colony, should have a house. And I know we can do that. I know we can. Do you know why? Because 50 years ago, white people went to the moon. 50 years ago, white people went to the moon. And let me tell you something about the Apollo program. People went to the moon before pocket calculators were invented. They did that on slide rules, y'all. There were no calculators, and they sent dudes to the moon multiple times. And so now you're gonna tell me that we just aren't smart enough, we just can't figure it out, we can't have every human being have a minimally dignified home 50 years later, not on the moon, on the earth, homes on the earth, and now we have calculators, right? What a blessing, what a gift. Surely, again, the people we are fighting, among others, are politicians, so the people who've taken responsibility for making sure our lives aren't terrible, right? And these industries that are sponsoring gentrification, finance, and tech, they tell us that they are the cognitive elite. They tell us they are the smartest people on the history of planet Earth. The things they are doing, you and I, we could never figure it out. Programming, we couldn't do that. Computer stuff, I don't know. Fake financial instruments, you trade for other fake financial instruments? I'm not smart enough, I'll admit it. If I were, I wouldn't be at the Anarchist Book Fair. I would be trading them for one another in the Bahamas. They tell us they're the smartest people. They can fix anything. You know, Elon Musk, he's gonna disrupt the federal bureaucracy. But they can't fix this. Oh no, they can't fix this. And every time there's gonna be a gentrifying mega project, they're gonna build that tech campus, they're gonna expand the university, they always act like they really don't wanna displace anyone, right? That's why they do the community benefits agreements. That's why they have listening sessions. That's why they invite people to come to council and give their perspective. Because this time, we really don't want to displace anyone. So we will do our best to figure out the right numbers and the right incentives to not displace anyone. And then time after time, every time in fact, the smartest people on the planet mess up. They mess up. And it's like, whoops, we did ethnic cleansing again. Oh, we really tried. We thought this time we wouldn't do it, but I guess the CPA wasn't big enough. And it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because think about it. The university builds a new research center and no one gets displaced. Where do the researchers live? Unless there's 500 vacant units right next door, all the researchers are like sleeping in the parking lot every night. That doesn't make sense. 10,000 worker tech campus gets built and no one gets displaced. Ugh, all of a sudden, you know, you can't walk downtown anymore because there's 10,000 unhoused techies everywhere, you know, panhandling for Soylent money. That doesn't make any sense. None of these projects make any sense logically without displacement. They logically depend on a displacement as a condition of possibility. So these people saying, we're trying to figure it out. We got it wrong 500 times before, but this time we'll do it. They are lying. They are lying. They are lying to us and to themselves and to God. And what the consequence of this is that communities get destroyed, right? We just had a campaign in Philly to stop our Chinatown, one of the oldest remaining in the country, to keep it from getting turned into not even an inconveniently located downtown basketball arena, but like the parking lots and hotels outside an inconveniently located basketball arena. And we won. Yeah. I mean, look, the fight's never over. These communities are always profitable for reinvestment. So the struggle continues. But yeah, that will not be built. We won, we beat it. Like, there's no plan B for Chinatown. There's no like backup Chinatown, some like slightly worse, long-standing, downtown, centrally located Chinese community that people could just move to. It's like, oh, now we have to move to like worse China. It's like, no, that will just no longer exist in this city if it is destroyed. Right? And we can see that, like, because these are concentrated ethnic enclaves, there is no replacement for them. this is the one place people could live when they came from the deep south to work factory jobs, and this is where the church is, and this is where the history is, and this is like the place where like my mom grew up. Like, there's no replacement for that. Like, this is the one community where my mom can go to the store and buy things, even though she only speaks Vietnamese. And if we get priced out of here, I guess my mom just won't talk to anyone anymore. Like, there is no replacement. There is no alternative, to quote Margaret Thatcher. That's not the same for the people who are moving to gentrify, right? It's like, I graduated MIT and I got my like CS degree, and like I could work at Google or I could work at Facebook or I could work at whatever. And it's like, yeah, it's whatever. It's just you shop around, whatever. There are no plan Bs. There are no backups. There are no replacements for gentrified communities. When they're gone, they're gone. When these communities are gone, they're gone. The kinds of people we can be when we're in community with one another, when we can see each other, we can understand each other, we can literally, linguistically understand one another, they're gone. That is the consequence of gentrification. It's not the inconvenience of moving to a new place. It's the death of our social selves. And that's why people are willing to fight so hard to preserve these communities. And there are people who say, oh, well, this is reformist, because you just want people to stay in the same houses. Or, you know, God forbid a small business owner in a community supports the fight, so now you're like collaborationists. Those people are morons, unfortunately, because this is the most visible front in the contemporary class struggle. It's a big claim, but they gave me a microphone so I can say whatever I want. These are people who are fighting directly the commanding heights of the contemporary neoliberal economy. We had a period of struggle where the most active fights were at the point of production, at work, right? Class struggle, we think of it as something that workers do at work. But work has also transformed. That's why we have gentrification. Most people, the less money you make, the more likely you are to work at a small business, like a mom and pop, as an independent contractor, or in the gig economy, right? That means the less leverage that you have. You unionize at a small business, the most likely thing that will happen is it will go out of business. You got 40 coffee shops in your town and one of them has to pay for your health care? Yeah, people aren't gonna pay 10 bucks for a cup of coffee. That's the truth. People used to be concentrated in large workplaces that were the center of the global economy, like those Ford plants. Ford wasn't going to go out of business if you demanded a living wage. The bodega will. The people who get concentrated now at large workplaces are people who have no interest, no material interest in the fundamental transformation of the economy, because they are the employees at tech firms, they're the employees at elite universities, where even the grad students are training to get these kinds of jobs, right? They express no fundamental universal interest in their struggle. What we have seen happen empirically, if you do the materialist analysis that people talk about so much, we have seen the nexus of class struggle transformed from the point of production to the point of reproduction. Because we don't stop being workers when we clock out at the end of the day. We're workers when we go home, when we're taking care of our kids, when we're making lunch for them tomorrow, when we're caring for our grandparents. We still have our class positions. So if we are struggling based on our class interests, that is, in fact, the class struggle. So we have seen the people who are confronting most directly the most powerful people in the global economy are folks fighting for their homes. And I think the only reasons why people aren't acknowledging that are racism, purely racism, and this sort of nostalgic idea that class struggle has to look like what it looked like in 1917 or 1936 or 1968, which were all periods in time where, to return to an earlier theme, there weren't calculators, right? an entirely different world that was, yes, still emergent capitalism, but an entirely different system of production and exchange within it. These are the communities on the front lines. And I'm gonna leave some time for questions, but before that, I wanna say, on the topic of front lines, we need to talk about Gaza. And we need to talk about the connections between the US and Israeli economies. Who knows what the largest sector in the Israeli economy is? A lot of people think petroleum because it's the Middle East. That's not true. Israel has negligible petroleum reserves. It's tech. Tech is the largest economic sector in Israel. Gaza used to be a labor reserve. After it was captured from Egypt in the Six-Day War, people would get day passes to leave Gaza to work for Israeli capitalists. But the Israeli economy has transformed, just like the US economy has transformed, to no longer need a surplus population of racialized, low-skill, low-wage workers. And that is the economic precondition for a war of elimination. That's why they could create the blockade after the 2006 Hamas election. That's why they can starve 2 million people today. For the same reasons that your city councilor can plot to expel the Black, brown, and immigrant communities from the place where they are the representative. This is the gentrification economy at work. This is what we are up against. This is a kind of resistances and struggle that we need to consider, because these are the stakes. We cannot lobby our way out of this. We cannot legislate our way out of this. Because again, look at the federal government. The people who have been doing this, for over a decade, the Musks and the Zuckerbergs have been handed the keys to the palace. They have direct political control under autocracy. We cannot lobby our way out of this. We cannot ask city council for one little tweak to fix the housing crisis, because it is against their interests, because their interests are not ours. I invite people to think about this. I invite people to connect with the Binghamton Tenants Union. But most of all, I want people to think about how we learn from the struggles around us without the blinders of ideology, both capitalist and our own, how to look at the actual class struggles that surround us with fresh eyes, and how to look to the communities who have been engaged in these struggles, not as potential recruits, not as people to proselytize to, but as folks who have the expertise and the experience in survival and in struggle. Because though our enemies are powerful, I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that we will win. I believe that there are people listening to this on this loading dock who will outlive these things, who will outlive empire, who will outlive settler colonialism, who will outlive the housing market. That is the objective. We all know that there are things that must not be bought or sold. Love, people. There are things we cannot buy or sell, even under capitalism. And we all need a home. We all need a place to be ourselves, ideally, to care for one another, to have a refuge from the world, from the elements. Why should that be bought and sold on the private market? Because as long as it is, the housing crisis will continue. As long as it is, gentrification will continue. As long as it is, our neighbors will die on the streets, and that is why we need to fight today, tomorrow, until victory. Thank you. So, like, during the period of urban renewal, the role of the state was obvious because the state would just say, oh, this black neighborhood, you're a highway now. Everyone get out. And what we've seen with gentrification is an increased role of finance and real estate firms. Like, after 2008, there was a huge wave of financialization, which simply means that if you're renting, odds are you aren't just renting from like a local rich person. You're probably renting from a regional or national rich company, right? That's what financialization means. So on one hand, gentrification can look very different, but we shouldn't get confused. This can make it seem like gentrification is just a sort of like automatic process, and it's the invisible hand of the market, and there's no one to blame. And I just want us to think about what evictions are, right? Most people self-evict, right? Most people don't wait for the sheriff to show up for obvious reasons, but no one would move out if the sheriff was never going to show up, right? Gentrification depends on state violence. It depends on the threat of state violence. So there is still a predominant role of state power, both in capitalist democracies and in more autocratic states. So that, in fact, is the same, right? And one way to get people out is to make them uncomfortable, to make it more expensive, all of these things. Another way is to arrest or kill them. Like, one of the things that keeps property values down is interpersonal violence and the perception of criminality. So there is often a very strong element of state pacification. It's all bad. It's all bad. And I mean, like, that's the thing that kills me about this, right? Is like, there was white flight and it was really bad, right? All the resources leave. There's no funding for anything. And then there's like white return and it's also bad because now that the neighborhood's nice, you have to leave. And one of the most painful things to think about this for me in thinking about displacement gentrification is like folks looking at their neighborhoods getting improvements, and it's terrifying. They fix the streetlights and it's terrifying. There's a grocery store and it's terrifying because people know that must not be for me. If there's nice stuff, it must not be my neighborhood anymore, because that's not for me. And for folks who haven't had that experience personally, I just want folks to consider what it's like to carry that throughout one's life. Throughout one's life. At work, at school, at home, hang out with your friends. To have that knowledge that if there's nice stuff, that means I have to go. And the effects that has on a person throughout their lives, has intergenerationally, has communally, I don't know. It's hard. It's very hard. Check out the work from the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project in the San Francisco Bay Area. They're very cool. They do a lot of like spatial analysis type stuff. I think some of their stuff engages with like redlining data. I don't know how much of it does, but they're very cool, and they're like our people. It's like an activist collective of folks who are just really good at GIS and do like very, very cool like mapping projects that are all freely available. There was actually labor organizing as well in the microchip factories in Silicon Valley that gets erased a lot. I think the labor movement is hard because it can actually, in the present day, come down on either side of gentrification, right? Sometimes it's like, we want the new university research center because we don't get to represent the custodians unless there are custodians. We want the new tech campus because we don't represent cafeteria workers unless there is a cafeteria. And then sometimes unions can take a more principled stance. The thing that kills me is like, this is something that will harm your existing members, right? Just like the politicians who are plotting their own constituents' removal. Gentrification is bad for workers. It's bad for working people. It's bad for your existing members. And you know, so much of these labor movements have been about preserving these jobs with mixed results, honestly, because now Detroit is also heavily gentrifying in the downtown core around Wayne State. A comrade did a really thorough critical review of my book in a publication called The Brooklyn Rail, where he talks about that very dynamic of the sort of like bohemian countercultural left getting sort of co-opted by capital. And so I would recommend looking at that because I think he actually goes into that way better than I did. But also on the topic of squatting, I think something to take from that is like decommodification of housing is not some pie in the sky utopian ideal. If you squat a building, it's decommodified because you didn't pay for it, right? Housing was decommodified on about half the planet in the Soviet bloc for like a good chunk of the 20th century. It was fine. If you form a community land trust, which exists in hundreds of cities across the country, the housing in the community land trust is decommodified, right? So it seems like this crazy thing, but like you can do it yourself. Again, housing has been decommodified about half the planet Earth for decades. Housing is being decommodified every year, even under capitalism, in the United States. It's not some crazy utopian vision. It's something we can make happen. But if we're going to stop displacement, that needs to be the horizon and nothing less.